For the week of January 3rd, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 36, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I am Karen Woodward.
And at the local Dairy Queen, already breaking my New Year's resolution, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're not really at a Dairy Queen this week. I know that last week you were at the Cranky Cafe in Long Island City, but you're not at a Dairy Queen this week, are you?
No, not literally.
Okay, because that was a...
It's awfully quiet.
Yes, it is awfully quiet.
Well, everybody else is sticking to their New Year's resolution. I'm the only one.
So the Dairy Queen is empty. Well, we should tell you that we're coming to you a little late this week because I had some internet connectivity problems. And before
Time Warner.
Yes, thank you, Time Warner. We'll be talking about them a little later on in the show with Jonathan Handel during our Inside Baseball segment. And before we get started, and before I tell you that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or that you can email us your comments and thoughts at dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or even call us toll-free at 888-567-SAND. Before I tell you any of that, we should probably congratulate journalist David Poland, who is the founder and editor of Movie City News and The Hot Blog. He had a son over the weekend. Cameron Wallace Poland was born on January 3rd, 2010. I almost said June 3rd. I'm way ahead of myself.
Congrats to him. That's sweet.
Of course, David has appeared on this podcast a couple of times.
Do you think he's named after Cameron Crowe?
I don't know, and I highly doubt it.
James Cameron?
I can understand why you think he's named after James Cameron, given this week's box office.
Exactly. The New Year's weekend was another remarkable week at the box office. Three films grossed over $30 million, seven films grossed over $10 million. It was just a massive weekend, and of course at the top of the list is Avatar, another $68 million. It only dropped 9.7%. It's already grossed $352 million in the U.S. Total worldwide is $1 billion. It's one of only five films in history to gross more than $1 billion, and it hasn't even begun to slow down yet. The only question now is, Will it beat Titanic? It will become the second biggest grossing film of all time worldwide. Will it catch up to The Dark Knight in the U.S., and will it catch up with Titanic in the U.S.? That's the big question remaining. Number two, though, is another huge film. Sherlock Holmes, $38 million, a huge hit for Robert Downey Jr. Now he has two franchises. It's grossed $140 million total. Number three was Alvin and the Chipmunks, the squeakquel. Whoever called it the squeakquel deserves a huge, fat end-of-the-year bonus check. It grossed $36 million. It's at $157 million U.S. and should tie the original, which grossed $217 million in the U.S. And that's another big hit for Betty Thomas, a female director. Another female director, Nancy Myers, is at number four with It's Complicated, the Meryl Streep film that grossed $18 million. That's starting to show good legs. It's at $60 million in the U.S. and looks like it might get to $100 million. Number five is The Blind Side, which is just remarkable. It grossed another $12 million. It's at $209 million total. Number six is George Clooney's Up in the Air at $11 million. That's at $45 million total. And it probably needs some really serious awards attention, which I hope it'll get, to turn it into a really big hit. The Princess and the Frog grossed $10 million. It's at $86 million and still has to be considered a disappointment. And then did you hear about The Morgans? Grossed $5 million, thanks in part to me, because I went to see it. It grossed $25 million total. Nine, the musical, is dead in the water. It grossed $4 million. It's lucky to have grossed $9 million. It's at $14 million total. And they probably expected to gross $99 million. So that's really a flop, the biggest flop of the fall, I'd say. And Invictus is at 10 with $4 million. It's at $30 million total. It needs awards in order to turn into a modest loss into a modest gain. And Twilight Saga is still chugging along at $3.6 million with $287 million total. Well, so I went to see, did you hear about The Morgans? Did you guys see any movies this weekend?
No.
Oh, my gosh. Are you going to go see Avatar?
I don't think so.
The biggest movie in the history of movies.
No, it's not.
It's getting there.
It's not going to beat Titanic.
U.S. or worldwide? U.S. is hard because it's at $350 million U.S. It needs to gross another $550 million to tie Titanic in the U.S. That is a very, very – has to double, more than double what it's already grossed. That is a huge order.
Yeah, worldwide, I'm thinking U.S.
Worldwide, however, it's a lot easier, relatively speaking. It needs to gross $800 million, but it's an easier task.
Well, last night on the local evening news here in Los Angeles, they did a story about how Avatar has become an event film. And I guess they were also talking about what Patrick Goldstein wrote about in his column in the Los Angeles Times about how the right-wing Republicans have come out to attack the film based on its its content of, you know, and it has an environmental subplot.
Anti-colonialism.
Right.
Pro-environment.
Yeah.
All that wishy-washy leftist stuff.
And I'm thinking, you know what? If they're writing stories like this 3 weeks after the film has come out, people are going to it not for the plot, but for the experience.
Duh, they're not going for the plot.
There is no plot, from what I understand.
Well, it's not that there's no plot. It's just that it's kind of a hackneyed story. But I think that people like experiences. It's why they like the iPhone, the experience of using it.
Oh, it's why they like mini. Compare Avatar to the iPhone.
Well,
why not?
I'm comparing it to products that have
a
good experience.
I think it's the same thing. I understand what you're saying.
I think the Mini Cooper is the same. You know, it's a fun car. Well, this is an interesting movie that everybody's seeing, and so stay a part of the water cooler culture, you have to see it.
Yeah, no question. When a movie's a big hit, people want to see what everybody else is talking about, no question. But whether it's going to gross another $800 million to pass Titanic worldwide, that's a tall order. Well, the tale will be told next week. I mean, it hasn't even remotely slowed down yet. If it keeps burning along next week, then all bets are off, absolutely. But it will unquestionably become the second biggest film of all time in pure box office dollars. We know it will be number two. It will gross another $100 million and therefore become the second biggest worldwide title of all time.
And it entered the top 10 grossing films of all time, certainly of the decade, on Sunday, in only 17 days.
The ability to make so much money so quickly. Look at Twilight Saga, New Moon. I mean, that's, you know, made a ton of money, $270 million, whatever. But that was all made within the first four or five. I mean, it's the ability to push people in and see a movie is distorts things a little bit. We have to wait and see if it's going to, you know, the fact that it's made $1 million so fast doesn't mean it's going to make another $800 million. The legs just don't work like they used to. I remember when Titanic was in the theaters. My God, that movie made $20 million weekend after weekend after weekend after weekend for like 6 months. It was unbelievable. So, you know, Avatar can make a ton of money so fast. It doesn't mean that 6 weeks from now, people aren't going to be all over it and bored with it like they are with Twilight Saga.
Well, Cameron's Titanic, and this just goes to show you and put it into some perspective to show you how much ticket prices have risen. That film was released December 19th, 1997, and it took almost 8 weeks to reach $341.8 million, which is where Avatar stands right now.
But that's not just because of ticket prices. That's because movies open on so many more screens, and they can get in so many more people so much more quickly.
Yes, and actually, I was talking to someone from Deluxe this past week, who is the motion picture lab that serviced the film and worked with Fox to help distribute it. And He said it was the first time they had distributed more digital prints than 35mm prints.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of
cool. What do they mean, distribute digital prints?
Send
out. The whole point was you don't distribute prints.
Well, no, you send them out. You know, you send them out.
Okay, so they meant they send out files to each individual?
Correct.
Theater?
Yes.
And the theater can use that digital file on its multiple screens, or do they need a file for each screen that they use it on?
They need one file and a key for each screen.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is really a game changer. If you think about how he's said, I have to wait until there are enough theaters built with good enough screens and 3D so I can show my movie. that's pretty amazing. That's a real game changer.
For 3D, I think.
Yes.
Not for anything else. Because this is not, aside from the 3D aspect, from what I understand, this is not a real game changer in terms of story and
it's not a good movie. No.
Yeah. Can you imagine if it had been a good movie?
Even if it had been as good as Titanic.
I was surprised, Michael, that you didn't mention, though not a game changer, that The Blind Side actually rose 10% over the weekend.
It grossed more than the brand new George Clooney film that's gotten tremendous reviews. It's really amazing.
Well, another film that got tremendous reviews, but a lot of people did not see, was The Hurt Locker, which is a film I hope that as it gets more awards buzz, people will at least catch on video. It's a very good film. It won the National Society of Film Critics Awards. It kind of swept, winning Best Picture, Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow, and Best Actor for Jeremy Renner.
Good for her.
It's definitely the awards story of the year. It's definitely got, I think it's overshadowed Precious for momentum for the Oscars. There's no question. It's a front runner in all the big categories.
Yes, I agree.
And Kathryn Bigelow is definitely, you know, the director du jour. I can't imagine James Cameron winning twice. Jason Reitman is Hollywood royalty, I guess, son of Ivan Reitman. So I think it's maybe, you know, Kathryn Bigelow versus Jason Reitman for best director. And I think she's got a great shot of becoming, happily, the first woman to be named best director.
Well, I know.
Especially since Jason Reitman will have his turn later. He's still pretty young and pretty new.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's hopefully got a big career ahead of her, too.
Something I forgot to mention last week when we were talking about female directors and females in Hollywood and women in Hollywood is that this is the first year where a former husband and wife may be competing for best director, both James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow, who were once married.
Surely, or even people who are or were married, surely.
Yes.
I mean, nobody's ever been nominated at the same time in the same year. There's so few women. That's awesome.
Well, now speaking of women, you highlighted a story here about Nancy Myers and Betty Thomas, two female directors who have done quite well for themselves and quite well for the studios for whom they have made movies.
That's right. I mean, I've been talking for a while how Sandra Bullock is the biggest female star in the world. You know, arguably close to the biggest star in the world. Certainly she's right up there with Will Smith and whoever else you may think is on the male side. But there's also Catherine Bigelow is a huge critical success, and she turned Hurt Locker into a commercial hit based on how much money it cost to make. But I don't think enough attention has been paid to Nancy Myers, who has delivered her fifth film and really her fifth success story in a row. She works in a genre of romantic comedies that are kind of hard to turn out and are often less expensive, obviously, than massive, complex films. And she's proven really successful both in the U.S. and overseas. Her list of movies are The Parent Trap, which did very little overseas but was a good hit in the U.S., and then the Mel Gibson movie What Women Want, which made $372 million worldwide. Something's Gotta Give with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton, which made $266 million worldwide. The Holiday with Cameron Diaz, which looked like it was a flop for her to a degree. It only made $63 million U.S., but it made $140 million overseas. So it made over $200 million worldwide. And now she's got It's Complicated, which is just starting its overseas run and has made $60 million in the U.S. And you know, this is a very dependable, big commercial director, and she should be, you know, on that list of top directors that studios are looking at.
Back to the question of age, you know, Jason Reitman versus Catherine Bigelow. I think it's interesting that Catherine Bigelow, Nancy Myers, and Betty Thomas. Thank you. Are all older. Because Jason Reitman is, what, 32 or something? 28? Certainly no older than 35. And these women are, you know, in their 50s, even in their 60s.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what women directors out there under the age of 35 are making studio movies. I can't think of one.
Good heavens. I try to focus on a positive story and bring attention to women, and you make it a downer.
I'm just saying that it's interesting that they're all older.
Well, most directors tend to be older. You're right. But they love the hot young wunderkinds of the men.
Jane Campion.
Well, she's certainly a mature older director as well, yes.
I'm just trying to, you know, you put us on the spot, and I'm just trying to.
Somebody email us. Sperling, what's our email?
dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We'll read your email on the air.
But Karen, come on. We got Nancy Myers, Betty Thomas, Catherine Bigelow. This is good news for women.
That's three directors.
As opposed to last year when we had none. I'm just saying it's good when women succeed, and we need to bring more
like
attention to them.
The conversation is even happening about this because maybe it will help.
Well, helping out the box office this year were films like Harry Potter and Avatar. The box office officially closed at $10.61 billion in 2009, up 8%. The admissions were up 4%. It looks as if Warner Brothers finished with an industry record $2.13 billion and a 20% share of the box office. Paramount finished second with $1.46 billion, or 13.8% of the box office, and I guess we can thank Star Trek for that. Fox was third with $1.45 billion and 13.7%. Sony came in fourth place and earned $1.44 billion, or 13.6%, so Sony and Fox are neck and neck there. Disney came in fifth with $1.21 billion and 11.4%. Universal came in sixth, $900 million, 8.5% of the box office.
And I always feel like, you know what? What I want to know is how profitable were they? You know, I don't care what my ranking is. These studios love this stuff. Oh, I'm number one, I'm number two. Yeah, but if it took you 40 movies to become number two, big deal. And if you're number three with 12 movies and they were all profitable, that's really what matters to my mind. This stuff is just, you know, swinging penis. I don't want to say swinging dick. It's probably get angry at me.
So he says it anyway. I like that. That's pretty sweet. I love what Adam Fogelson, who is the chief now at Universal, said about 3D. He said, it's very much here, But while we have absolutely seen an uptick in box office revenue, the movies that have been released in 3D have faced an even tougher challenge in that the DVD releases of 3D films have performed less well and enough to question whether the total revenue was greater than a 3D film would have had in 2D. And I think The Hollywood Reporter needs a copy editor there.
That's a great point.
Well, yes, but what's interesting is that this is coming from an executive at Universal, which has yet to release a 3D film and has been very vocal about not wanting to get into the 3D game.
But it's a smart point, and you know what? When I get movies on 3D at home, I end up not using the glasses. I end up watching Coraline and Up and the others. I watch them in 2D because it's not pleasant to watch them on 3D at home. And I don't think
Don't you have to sit right in front of the TV? You can't.
It just doesn't work well. It just doesn't work. You got to wear the glasses. It's exhausting. It's not, you know, the experience isn't that awesome in a theater, frankly. But it's better, you know, with the nice new expensive glasses. It's a lot better than the cardboard ones you get with your DVD. It's just not a pleasant experience. And no, buying another 2000 TV is not going to change my mind about it.
Well, we will definitely be talking more about 3D in the home next week when we review CES, which is taking place right now. CES is the Consumer Electronics Show, which takes place every January in Las Vegas. I am sure that there will be tons of news about 3D television. I can guarantee you I'm getting one press release after another about it.
Absolutely.
But this year, or I should say last year, since we're in January already, I don't know why I can't say January today. Very odd.
You can just say June, and that'll be like our code word or something.
Yeah, June is the new January. Cinema surpassed DVD sales in 2009, according to Adams Media Research. They have box office pinned at $9.87 billion in 2009, 10% more than in 2008, whereas DVD sales, which long a cornerstone of movie studios' business models, plunged 13% to $8.73 billion, and this includes Blu-ray high-definition discs.
Yeah, they should say that DVD sales fell below box office sales, because box office sales kept growing. It's just DVD that really collapsed.
That's right. And of course, they point out that rental is on the rise. Rental transactions rose 5.5% in 2009. Rental spending rose less than 1% to $8.15 billion. And this is what Adams is calculating. Now, so that's sales of $8.73 billion and rental of $8.15 billion. So that's, you know, more than $16 billion in home video revenue.
So that you mean that figure of $8 billion doesn't include rentals?
No, it does not.
Oh, well, that's ridiculous. Why doesn't it include that?
DVD sales,
I said. That confused me. I thought sales had suddenly fallen much more than I expected. So they grossed $16 billion on sale and rentals of DVDs.
Yes.
All right. So it's more than they made at the box office. That's a huge amount of money.
Well, overall, consumers spent $28.38 billion on feature movies last year, Adams calculates, slightly lower than the $28.47 billion they spent in 2008. And that includes $1.27 billion spent on rentals through cable and satellite services and $361 million spent renting and buying movies online, both categories that grew considerably in 2009.
Well, if studios couldn't predict that in a recession, people would be less likely to take four people to the theater or buy a DVD and might be renting more often, then they're morons if they couldn't predict that thing coming up. And that's still a ton of money that never existed before. It's only come up in the mid-80s to now. You know, most of Hollywood history, they didn't get to more than double their box office on home video and rentals. And they're complaining because people aren't, you know, building their library at the rapid pace they did when DVDs were first introduced.
Especially during a time when there's some nervousness over, do I buy Blu-ray or should I just wait for streaming?
Right.
You know, there's this kind of wait and see mentality.
I couldn't believe how much video on demand cost. I was at my brother's and they wanted to watch Angels and Demons and they called it up on video on demand. It was $6.
Well, and wait a second. Is that the HD version or the standard def version?
It was the HD version, but I don't give a damn.
Yeah, I was a little surprised when the Time Warner guy was here fixing the internet. He turned around and handed me a brochure, and I was like, wow, look at all these films that are on video on demand for $4.99. There's no way I'm paying $4.99.
That's
a lot of money. I would. If I had nothing to do and I didn't like any of my movie choices that I own and I didn't feel like getting off my butt to go to the movies or to go rent something, yeah, I would pay $5 to see a movie.
She said, but.
I know.
Hey, better than.
Beavis and Butthead Do America is actually a very good movie, by the way. But it's a lot of fun. But you know, we'll talk later about pricing and prices. And Sperling talks about giving things away for free and bringing in customers to get more stuff later down the road. And I think, you know, charging extra for Blu-ray is stupid. I think charging extra for high def is stupid. Make it the same price as regular DVD. They have to buy a $1,500 TV. They have to buy all this stuff to make it, you know, work. And then to charge them extra on top of it because you think, oh, I can get an extra few bucks. It just lowers the value of what they're getting. I don't think it's very smart. I think you should penalize people for buying Blu-ray. Shouldn't penalize them for having a massive TV and wanting a high def.
Yeah,
just,
people,
you know,
are stupid.
Make it as inexpensive as possible.
Well, the end of this year is also the end of the decade, and some of the big critic aggregation sites like Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes released their top 10 reviewed films of the decade. And I can thank Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood for pointing this out. It looks like Metacritic's top 10 best reviewed movies of the decade in number one, Pan's Labyrinth, 98%. Ratatouille got a 96. Spirited Away, a 94. And so far, 2 and 3 are animated films. Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King got a 94 as well. Sideways, the 2004 comedy, got a 94. WALL-E, the Pixar film, got a 93 and is in sixth place. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, released in 2000, got a 93. There Will Be Blood, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, comes in at eighth with 92. The Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, the first of the first film in the trilogy, a 92 in ninth place, and The Queen is in 10th place with 91. Rotten Tomatoes is a little different. Man on Wire, a documentary, came in first with 141 reviews. It scored a 100%. Up, scored 98%. The Wrestler, 98%. Finding Nemo, 98%. So I guess all these films came in pretty close to one another. Anvil, the story of Anvil, came in at 98%. I found it kind of funny. I was on Variety the other day, and I saw a four-year consideration ad for Anvil for Best Picture. And I thought, wow, you know, look at that. The campaign that has an ego as large as the subject of that documentary.
Because have you seen that documentary?
I have, and there's no way it's going to be nominated for Best Picture. It's a fun, interesting documentary about a heavy metal band that kind of never made it, but there's no way it's being nominated
for
Best Picture.
Well, I think since they weren't on the short list for Best Documentary, correct? I think that they had their money that they were promised to spend, and so they spent it on Best Picture because they couldn't spend it on urging it for Best Documentary.
Well, that's true. But I wonder if any of these films that I'm mentioning now, including Maria Full of Grace, 97%, Winged Migration, a documentary at 97%, The Incredibles at 97%, I wonder if any of these films will actually make the Library of Congress's National Registry.
What is that?
Well, funny you should ask. Every year, the Library of Congress picks 25 films to place into a national registry. So far, 500 films have been selected. It was created in 1989 by the National Film Preservation Act. Each year, Congress picks, or this registry picks, films that are deemed, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, and the selections are culled from hundreds of titles nominated by the public, members of the National Film Preservation Board, and the library's motion picture staff. Now, to be eligible to be entered into the registry, a film has to be more than 10 years old. And all titles in the registry are available for screening free of charge at the Library of Congress on Capitol Hill. So, you know, bring your headphones and go plug in and watch some movies. This year, there's some interesting picks. 1938's Jezebel, directed by William Wyler, that won Betty Davis her second Oscar. The 1957 sci-fi classic The Incredible Shrinking Man, another William Wyler film, the World War II British drama Mrs. Miniver, which earned six Oscars, including Best Picture. 1959's Pillow Talk, which starred Doris Day and Rock Hudson, and is kind of considered to be a time capsule of 1950s America. Sergio Leone, probably best known for spaghetti westerns and working with Clint Eastwood, his 1968 epic Once Upon a Time in the West was selected, and it's marked as a peak of the spaghetti western genre. Sidney Lumet's 1974 film, I want to say, Dog Day Afternoon, starring
75.
Stars Al Pacino in a film about a bank robbery gone awry, and Jim Henson's 1979 The Muppet Movie was also selected. But what kind of shocked me was that Michael Jackson's 1983 music video for Thriller was selected. That video was directed by John Landis.
Well, I mean, you know, it's certainly culturally significant.
That's true.
But how it's not a movie. Well, I guess you could argue it was. It's about 25
minutes
long.
They have documentaries and shorts and all sorts of things, not just feature films, so...
But let's go back up to the best reviewed movies again. How many of those movies have you guys actually seen?
I've seen them all except for Anvil, The Story of Anvil.
I've even seen Murderball, the documentary about paraplegics playing some kind of weird crash.
Murderball.
Yeah, Murderball.
Yeah, no, it was supposed to be great.
It's a great film.
It's fun. It's a good movie. I thought, looking at the Metacritic list, I think The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers was screwed because Return of the King and The Fellowship of the Ring made the list, but not The Two Towers.
Yeah, it's odd, right? I'm surprised Ratatouille was that high. I mean, I know that when it came out, people really loved it. I thought it was only, I don't know, maybe it's my cartoon bias, but I wasn't particularly impressed with it.
Yeah, Ratatouille, Spirited Away, The Incredibles, those are all films that I love. Most of the movies on the list I love. The ones I don't think belong on there, I think Sideways is probably a little overrated.
Way overrated.
Yeah, and The Queen, I think, is a good movie with a very good performance, but not a great movie. It's like it's an elevated TV film. Other than that, Chicken Run shouldn't be up there. That's not that. I love Nick
what
Park.
What the hell is that doing there?
That's not that good. Once is a nice, lovely film, but I wouldn't put it that high.
97%, yeah.
Yeah, so that's it. The others, I think, were all on my best of the year list for those years, every single one of them. So,
well, you know, you said that Sideways is overrated. However, I was at a wine tasting recently, and some of the vintners that were there, and they were pretty well-known, Duckhorn and Merrivale and pretty well-known U.S. vintners, were talking about how that movie really impacted their sales of
Merlot. Yeah, of course.
They were like, you know, well, Pinot Noir kind of saw this rise in their mid-2000s thanks to that movie. They call it that movie. They never mentioned it by name. And they said, but Merlot's making a comeback finally, which we're happy to see because it's a good grape and blah, blah, blah. You know,
that's the great scene with Paul Giamatti. He's like, no, if they order Merlot, I'm gone. I'm out of here.
I will not drink Merlot. Well, I know a lot of people are looking back over the last decade and over the last year. It looks as if a few people are looking forward, including Variety, who says that there could be some changes in television over the next year. But that's kind of like, I mean, is that news? Of course there's going to be changes. Some of the changes that they point out, of course, are Comcast and NBC Universal. They think that Jeff Zucker will stay on after the merger.
Well, they don't say that Jeff Zucker is definitely going to stay on. They say that he has signed a new contract, but that they don't really know what will happen once Comcast gets the keys.
Ron Meyer, on the other hand, who is, I guess, the chairman or CEO or president of Universal.
Grand Poobah.
Grand Poobah, he just can't wait to get out of there. The only reason he's sticking around is to see the merger through.
He probably wants to retire. I mean, how old do you think he is now?
He's in his 50s.
Yeah, he was always young.
That's a little early to retire, isn't it?
Yeah.
Think about what he's been going through at Universal. How many owners has he gone through?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, he just wants some stability, even if that means knowing he won't get a paycheck every week. The other thing that Variety points out, and this is an article by Michael Schneider of Variety, is that the 8-year, $52 million Emmy contract is set to expire. And the heat is on for the TV Academy to make a new deal with broadcasters, and will they or won't they? Speaking of will they or won't they, Simon Cowell, who makes around $45 million a year, as we've discussed in the past, is not committed to American Idol beyond this year. And many people think this is the year that X Factor finally gets its due here in the United States, which is another Simon Cowell creation.
Well, it's literally American Idol. I mean, it's the same type show with a little twist. So I can't imagine him wanting to take X Factor to the fall on Fox and while American Idol is in the spring, because the one thing he always because they wanted to have another episode in the fall, they wanted two a year just like they do with Survivor. They want to just keep the show going, and he said, no, that's a disastrous idea. You've got to let people get a rest from the show. You have to let the people release their albums, and people will get sick of the show a lot quicker if you just play it all year long. And he literally threatened to quit if they tried to run the show twice a year. And so I can't imagine him wanting to have X Factor in the fall and Idol in the spring. I think that would just be a disaster.
Well, another question remains about whether Ellen DeGeneres will work on the show as a judge. Of course, Paula Abdul is no longer on the show, and it's going to have some stiff competition in February with the Winter Olympics. So it could be an interesting first half of the year television-wise.
Wait, did you say that there's a question about whether Ellen DeGeneres will be a judge?
No, will work as a judge.
No, how she'll do.
Oh, okay.
They said there's a lot of changes. They're facing the Olympics. They've got a new judge for the, you know, they've got four judges, including Ellen DeGeneres and Nat Paula. Simon's contract is up. It's a year of turmoil for American Idol, no question.
And Schneider points out that a clearer picture will emerge of what will happen with Jay Leno and, frankly, what will happen with Conan O'Brien, who hasn't been doing that well, and what will happen with Oprah Winfrey and her new network, OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Certainly, we'll know a little bit more towards the end of the year, since that is meant to launch, I think, January 1st, 2011. Here are some of the questions that remain. Is an ad recovery in the cards, and how might that be reflected during the spring's upfront sales season? Have local stations seen the worst of their economic slowdown, or are more waves of layoffs in the offing? Is this the year the networks finally, truly start taking summer seriously, or will they once again cede viewership and momentum to cablers? Also, will a viable cross-platform ratings measurement from Nielsen emerge to satisfy its frustrated network clients? Will rumors of a pay service on Hulu come to fruition? Will rumors of Disney's and CBS's involvement in Apple's subscription TV venture come true? And what will it look like? With the Guild contracts up in 2011, will the saber rattling begin once again? So,
well, let's put that in English. The cross-platform ratings measurement from Nielsen, all they're saying is, will they start to measure how many people are actually watching TV shows, whether it's, you know, they're playing them on Hulu or watching on the network site or watching them on DVR 7 days or the next day or that night. I mean, you know, they need to measure who's watching television.
Whether that will actually happen in 2010, personally, I doubt. I think we're probably looking closer to 2011, 2012.
It's so hard to do. Yeah.
Well, we'll be talking more about this probably next week when we discuss CES.
And summer, will the networks take summer seriously? They're not even taking Friday or Saturday night seriously. They've already seeded two nights of the week. Saturday is dead. They just run reruns, basically, except for Fox, which runs America's Most Wanted and Cops. And Friday night, the networks are practically giving up on that as well. It's crazy. They have this prime real estate two nights of the week when people used to watch tons of TV. Big top 10 hit shows were on Friday and Saturday nights, like Miami Vice and Golden Girls. And they have just stopped programming those nights practically. They've given up. They've thrown the towel. And it's a crazy waste of real estate. And so are they going to take summer seriously? Well, they don't even take 2 days of the week seriously. So
they barely
they
take fall and winter and spring seriously.
I know. My God, speaking of not taking it seriously, I'm sorry. It's the first week of January. People are still home. ABC had the caravan, the conveyor belt of love.
Oh, did you see that? That was awful, wasn't it?
I watched this thing. It was literally the most god-awful. People should have been fired the next day. It was so low rent. It looked cheap for like a late-night MTV show, much less a network primetime show. It was so awful. I couldn't believe it.
I tried to watch NCIS Los Angeles last night.
And that's not good.
I was very impressed with Chris O'Donnell. Very impressed.
Oh, I
LL
like him
Cool
a lot.
J, lacking. Give that guy some acting classes.
Maybe we should, maybe NCIS instead of LL Cool J as a star. They should have had Bono as a star.
Okay, is that your way of segmenting into Bono's op-ed piece in the New York Times?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, yeah, Bono had an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times that ruffled a few feathers, and not because it talked about things like the automobile as a sexual object and the return of the automobile as a sexual object, I should say, or global warming, or angiogenesis, or quantum teleportation, or the Festival of Abraham, an arts festival that celebrates the origin of the three Abrahamic religions. But I'm reading here, can you tell?
Who said it ruffled feathers?
Well, this is where it ruffled feathers, and this is why it made news. He's looking ahead into the next 10 years. Rather than doing a best of list, he's doing a best, you know, what to look forward to in the next 10 years. He talked about the threat of intellectual property piracy. And of course, being a musician, he's somewhat concerned about that. He says, caution, the only thing protecting the movie and TV industries from the fate that has befallen music and indeed the newspaper business is the size of the files. The immutable laws of bandwidth tell us we're just a few years away from being able to download an entire season of 24 in 24 seconds. Many will expect to get it for free. A decade's worth of music file sharing and swapping has made clear that the people it hurts are the creators. In this case, the young, fledgling songwriters, who I am not, who can't live off ticket and t-shirt sales like the least sympathetic among us. And the people this reverse Robin Hooding benefits are rich service providers whose swollen profits perfectly mirror the lost receipts of the music business. We're the post office, they tell us. Who knows what's in the brown paper packages? But we know from America's noble effort to stop child pornography, not to mention China's ignoble effort to suppress online dissent, that it's perfectly possible to track content. Perhaps movie moguls will succeed where musicians and their moguls have failed so far, and rally America to defend the most creative economy in the world, where music, film, and TV and video games help to account for nearly 4% of gross domestic product. Note to self, don't get over-rewarded rock stars on this bully pulpit, or famous actors. Find the next Cole Porter if he, she hasn't already left to write jingles.
Well, I mean, he's stating the obvious that they got to worry about bandwidth and people will start swapping movies and TV shows just like they did music. I disagree when he says the only people who got hurt are the artists. The major record labels also got massively hurt. So did all the hundreds of newspapers that have gone out of business. So it's not just the little guy. Big guys are getting hurt too.
Yeah, but the record labels had an opportunity to see what was right in front of them and do something about it. And instead, they closed their eyes and they, you know, shoved their head in the sand. Whereas songwriters or actors or creators, they don't have that luxury of having the power to do something about it, except to speak up.
I'm just saying stealing doesn't hurt just creators. The people it hurts most aren't just creators. It's also, you know, it will be the TV studios and the movie studios and the major conglomerates, because they'll lose billions of dollars of business. Regardless of how smart they should have been to prevent it, it doesn't justify stealing. So people shouldn't steal.
Well, I think in this case, what got everybody up in arms is that whole thought of ISPs, internet service providers, actually monitoring the traffic on their networks and selectively not putting packets through because, you know, it might be a pirated video or a pirated song. I think it's very funny that Bono should be saying this, given that I tried to buy tickets for his shows here in April. Well, not his shows, but U2 shows here in April. And they were like $300 per ticket, not for a pair of tickets, $300 per ticket for the nosebleed seats.
Yeah, that's what happens when you're a superstar. I don't like it, but, you know.
No, I think it's a total ripoff, but that's a completely different subject.
Yeah.
Whether ISP should be policing, I actually think is an interesting concept. I don't think I'd be against it.
Ooh, don't go there.
I agree with Michael. You can't steal, because that really does hurt everybody. So somebody's got to police. Someone has to police the internet. Unfortunately, somebody has to do it.
Well, I would just like to say that when you send your emails in, please address them to Karen.
Karen at showbizsandbox.com. I'm checking right. It. I'm not getting anything.
Not yet. Well, that's really the last news story I have highlighted for this week, except for the ones that we have in Big Deal or Big Whoop, our very popular segment that reviews all of the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. The first news story this week is actually kind of reverts back to something we discussed earlier. Flixster bought Rotten Tomatoes. Now, Flixster is, I guess, a social networking service that gained a lot of popularity when it launched, thanks to its integration with Facebook and MySpace. It allows its users to rate movies, and then you can kind of group yourself with friends and see how you rate with your friends. And whereas Rotten Tomatoes only allows film critics to rate the films and then kind of judges the films either rotten or fresh based on what the film critics had to say. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I guess it's a big deal in a sense. They fit together nicely. It makes a lot of sense. They complement each other, so it should work.
Karen?
Big deal. I think whenever a major website gets sold, to me, it's always a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Rotten Tomatoes was a standalone company for a while. It was sold to IGN Entertainment back in the mid-2000s. I don't know why IGN Entertainment, which is now owned by Fox, is selling it. It seems like
I thought that was weird, too.
It seems like it would be a cash cow.
One of their few, too. So
yeah, I mean,
yeah, that's a good point.
And Flixster, which when it launched, nobody thought would last because of Rotten Tomatoes, has 20 million unique visitors per month, and Rotten Tomatoes has 30 million, and yet Flixster's buying Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know. I mean, in the end, IGN Entertainment will have a minority stake in Rotten Tomatoes and the new company, but I don't get it. Lenny Kravitz says he did not leak Michael Jackson's song. So apparently Michael Jackson's, an unreleased Michael Jackson song, Another Day, a portion of it was released over the internet, and Lenny Kravitz, who produced and engineered the track, says it wasn't his fault, and he did this via a Twitter video, Karen. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay.
I say it's a big whoop, but it's cool that he used video on Twitter, and it's cool that he was in a tropical rainforest when he posted his little announcement. So it was cool, but a big whoop.
Yeah, I like the way he said, you know, I played all the instruments on the track, which I produced myself. I'm like, oh, modest much?
Did anybody listen to the music? I haven't heard it.
No, I haven't
so
listened
to
it.
So this was basically a plug for his music, right?
It was a
plug.
No.
It just was an unreleased track, and he's like, I didn't release this. I don't know who did, and it's a shame. That's
right.
All.
And he says it was working with Jackson was the most amazing musical experience he's ever had.
Okay, I just want to point out, though, that nobody goes on to – nobody posts a video for you know via Twitter if they're not trying to plug something.
Well, I think he – but that's not fair. I think, you know, you reach your audience, you're unfiltered, and if you want to make clear you didn't do something, it's a good way to reach
plug,
out quickly.
Plug, plug, plug. Call me a cynic. It's a plug.
And you would tell Lenny, get off social network, right?
No, I would say, what a wonderful use of social networking.
Oh, that's
to
a good
plug
one.
Yourself and this song that you did with Michael Jackson. And now think of how many people are interested in it because he just plugged it and we're talking about it and we've made this a news story.
Well, I guess we should move on. Do we want to move on to this Grey's Anatomy or Disney?
Yes, Kim Raver is joining Grey's Anatomy full time. Big deal, big whoop. Michael.
I guess it's a big deal the way he said it. She was a major player on 24. She's good. It could mean Katherine Heigl will finally leave and stick to her film career full time, which I don't think is necessarily a good idea. So it's a big deal. More drama at this show. The offstage stuff is much more exciting than the show itself.
I know. We should make a documentary.
Well, that probably sums it up. You know, I could care less. It's a big deal to me. I don't even know who Kim Raver is.
Oh.
Didn't you watch 24?
No.
Didn't you watch Lipstick Jungle or whichever show she was on?
No, I do not have Showtime. Or
you don't like
people.
To watch people get tortured?
It's not on Showtime.
Okay, I don't watch any of those shows.
Fox.
I'm too busy watching the top 20 reviewed movies of the decade.
You're too busy watching POW.
Which segues into another thing that I posted.
Disney acquiring a stake in Stanley's POW.
I thought this was interesting seeing as they just bought Marvel.
Well, right. And of course, Stan Lee ran Marvel for many years. Hasn't since, I guess, the early to mid 1990s. He is the creator of Spider-Man and other superheroes. And I guess they're now buying a 10% stake in his company for $2.5 million, which tells you how much that company is worth. Not a lot. $25 million, actually. You know, I guess really to me this is like a payday for Stan Lee to stick around while he consults with them on Marvel. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop as far as the size. 10% is not a lot and $2.5 million isn't a lot. But Powell's been doing some interesting stuff trying to develop the next, you know, the next world for comics by developing an online atmosphere and venue and style of comics. And so he's doing some interesting stuff. I don't think he ever actually ran Marvel. He was just a major creative force there. I don't think he was ever in charge, but maybe I'm wrong about that. But it keeps it all in the family. It's smart of Disney. Keeps Stan Lee happy. It's a good move.
Karen,
I agree. I think it's a bigger, it's a potentially bigger deal than we are giving it credit for because I think it's indicative of where Disney is looking to the future and their 14-year-old boys.
Yeah, you never know where the next idea. You know, we're plumbing the depths of every Marvel character, so you know they need new ones. So Powell could be the source.
Yeah, Disney. It's a smart move on Disney's part.
Well, he is. I have to say, I had dinner with him recently. I think a year or two ago, maybe. Yeah,
with Stan Lee.
With Stan Lee, and he's 83, 84 years old. So,
no, but he's not the main. He's like the face of it.
Right.
It's a lot of young talent, you know, and they're all trying to come up with. People aren't buying comic books as much in the store. What can we create online for them that will be exciting? So they're trying to develop some new spin on comic books that will survive online. They're not expecting Stan Lee to spin out whole new characters. That's not going to happen, you know.
Our next story is about Moon, the Duncan Jones film. A Twitter storm is brewing over missing screeners. I guess Sony sent out their screeners to Academy members and critics for the end-of-year voting, and Moon was not a part of it. Duncan Jones, on Twitter, on his own Twitter account, says, "We have more than asked. We've knocked heads. They have chosen the films they are backing, and we are not in their plans. They say it costs too much for our little film as they would need to be watermarked copies, given that our DVD isn't out yet in the U.S. Well, that's true, but all of those things are watermarked. All of those
I like how they're called missing screeners. I think they had to have been there at some point to be missing,
That's
right?
true. Now you do know who
Nice.
Duncan Jones is, right? Whose son he is?
Davy
David
Jones?
Bowie.
David Bowie, yeah.
He's Zoe Bowie. That's actually Zoe Bowie. You know,
Is
that
this
was
a
his original name.
well, is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a big deal to him, obviously, but it's a big whoop. It's a tiny film. They're not part of their push. It's almost on no 10 best lists. There's no, you know, momentum behind it. It's painful and hard for the filmmaker to deal with, but you're not going to spend 10, 20, 30 million trying to push it for Oscars. So, you know, sorry, but big whoop.
Karen?
And I saw it. It's a pretty good movie, you know.
I agree. It's a big whoop, but I do applaud him for going on Twitter and trying to plug, plug, plug.
Well, do you in that way, calling them out and acting like a baby and like, oh, how they're cheating us out? Does that really good relationships with the studio?
To him, he has done a smart thing and got on Twitter and plugged it. If he had a social media marketing agency behind him, they would say, don't act like a bloody baby.
If they had you with him, right? It doesn't seem like a good build good relationships with the studio. You know, you made a small film that didn't make any money. Why are you trying to make a fuss about the fact that they're not, you know,
no,
pushing it
he
for an
could have,
Oscar?
He could have and should have plugged this better. It's a good example of how not to use social media, but I applaud him for the thought.
Sam Mendes is going to direct the next James Bond film. Or so
he's in
says,
negotiations to direct the next James Bond film.
So is that a big deal, Karen?
Well, I think it is. I think it's an interesting choice.
Now, Sam Mendes.
I'm not sure I think he'd do a great job, but.
Well, this is the director who made Road to Perdition and American Beauty, and I'm sure I'm missing.
And Jarhead, Revolutionary Road, and Away We Go. None of which I like, and therefore I think it's a big deal because it's a bad choice of a director.
I think I agree for the same reason.
So it's a big deal because he's a big whoop
a
of a director.
Bad choice.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have no opinion whatsoever.
You don't have an opinion on who directs the next James Bond film. What kind of a man are you?
I'm a girly man. What can I say?
Oh, I'm going to quote you on that someday.
And title.
What do you have an opinion on?
At this point, you know.
I was trying to segue to inside baseball.
Oh, ask that question again.
Well, what do you have an opinion on?
You know, I really have an opinion on Fox versus Time Warner, which is our inside baseball segment. So we should probably get Jonathan Handel on the line, and I'll dial him up here on Skype with my right hand while I adjust our soundboard with my left hand.
Whoa, whoa.
Hey.
Dude, TMI.
All righty. Well, I didn't want there to be dead air. Well, that brings us to our last segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood may care or even understand, and that is especially true of this week's topic, which is the, I guess, dispute between Time Warner Cable and the Fox networks. Joining us to discuss this is Jonathan Handel, who is of counsel at Troy Gould here in Los Angeles. He is also an adjunct professor at the UCLA Law School. You can also read his writing at digitalmedialaw.blogspot.com. Thank you for joining us, Jonathan.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, now, can you explain a little bit about what was going on between the Fox Networks, or News Corp, and Time Warner Cable?
Yeah, what Fox wanted out of Time Warner was what's called sub fees or subscriber fees. They wanted to get paid, and their initial demand was a dollar per subscriber per month. Now, historically, broadcast networks did not get those fees, did not get any fees from the cable networks or from the from the cable networks. The cable operators is probably the best way of putting it. Only cable networks, whether an HBO, a premium network, or a History Channel, would get fees. Now, the issue for broadcast networks is that they were left only with advertising revenue. Ad revenue is down for two reasons. One is the economy has caused a lot of advertisers to cut back or to eliminate their ad spend altogether. And the other is that viewers have been migrating away from broadcast networks. They started by going to cable networks, of course, and that process started some 20 years ago, but it's accelerated because of the internet. People are spending more time doing other things. Actually, video games is a big problem for television networks as well, because people spend time on video games rather than watching network TV. But they also spend time on the internet, whether they're playing around on YouTube, or whether they're watching network programs on Hulu and other websites, legit sites like Hulu or pirate sites. So for all those reasons, broadcast networks are under a lot of pressure. And what they've said is, you know what? We can't survive on ad revenue alone. We want subscriber fees too. And CBS broke the barrier and is reportedly getting subscriber fees of roughly 50 cents per subscriber per month. You know, we want, I believe 50, maybe 30. But Fox, in any case, came in and said, you know, we want a piece of that action, and we want a real piece, because it's Fox Broadcast Networks and Fox Sports West and FX Cable and so forth.
Yes, yeah, Speed, Fuel TV, these are all networks owned by Fox, whether they're cable or broadcast. Of course, the Fox network is a broadcast network, not a cable network. And they wanted a dollar per subscriber, and Time Warner was offering 30 cents per subscriber per month.
That's right. Time Warner was offering 30. CBS is already getting 50, reportedly. And now, what this was a game of chicken. What you saw is each side placing ads in the newspapers, the LA Times and so forth, saying, your Fox channels may go dark, and it's the other guy's fault. you know, starting January 1st, and by the way, there's some real interesting college football games coming up, and, you know.
An American Idol.
An American Idol, exactly. And guess whose fault it's going to be? Well, you know, that got the attention of politicians, which is something that no media company wants.
I was surprised that they made it so public. I mean, now you have the FCC and senators looking at this whole concept of subscriber fees very, very closely.
They were very, very angry. That's right, because they respond to pressure from constituents, or play to constituents, as the case may be. And, you know, the FCC has started to say, you know, we're going to look more deeply into this, and we're going to revive the idea of unbundling, of forcing cable operators to sell cable networks on an a la carte basis, so that instead of having to buy, you know, tier one, tier two, whatever they call it on your particular cable system, that you'll be able to pick and choose which channels you want. And that's something the cable operators don't want, because it would cost them money. So, you know, we got down to the wire, went over the midnight deadline, but Time Warner did not black out Fox. And a few hours later, they settled. But the bigger question here is, what is the future of broadcast networks altogether? And in fact, are broadcast networks going to continue to exist in their current form? And, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that within the next several years that you may see one or more broadcast networks going all cable. Of course, as you've got a high percentage of households in the country, you know, that are wired, you know, that have cable and subscribe to cable or that watch stuff on the internet, more and more you get the question of, you know, why bother to broadcast over the air and subject yourself to more FCC regulation, have difficulties getting subscriber fees.
Now, can you describe a little bit the difference between broadcasting over the air versus watching the same network on your cable? Because I don't think people understand that there is a difference.
Well, that's right. A broadcast over the air is obviously over the air, and there's nothing intrinsically that makes that come through your cable. So you can have cable service or satellite service, DirecTV or Dish, that doesn't have local channels. So then you ask yourself, well, you know, most cable networks do have local channels. Why is that? There is a sort of a complicated two-part law that's called, it has two concepts in it. One is must carry, and the other is retransmission consent. Now, what does that mean? And we are in insider baseball here, that's for sure. but must carry says, gee, the cable company, the cable operator is forced, can be forced to carry the local channels if that's what the, you know, the local channels or the network wants. But then the flip side is, the network can say instead, you know what, we're not going to force you to carry our channels, but instead we're not going to let you carry our channels unless you pay us something or give us something in return. So let's sit down and negotiate. And that's retransmission consent, where the signal is not going to be retransmitted on cable unless the network consents. Now, in the past, what the broadcast networks have gotten is not subscriber fees, as I said, but they've gotten placement.
Cable channels, right?
They've gotten cable channels, exactly, because they own, for example, FX. When FX was new, how do you get a cable operator to carry FX when there's no established viewership? You say to them, well, you know, if you want Fox broadcast, we want you to take FX as well, and it'll grow, and here are our plans for it. So it's this weird two-part kind of hybrid system where you kind of choose to go down one path or the other, and that is the distinction, whereas over-the-air broadcast, the network or the local channels actually have broadcast licenses from the FCC, and that's what they need, and that's who they answer to, and that's it.
Now, Jonathan, when you talk about a major network going all cable, that would be pretty remarkable, isn't it? Because, I mean, let's not forget that it's only about 70% of households have cable.
Well, that's right. That's right. But the question...
So you're giving up 60, 70, 80 million people in one fell swoop.
Right. But are they, number one, are they people who are desirable to advertisers? Or are they people who don't have the level of income to support buying cable? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cold, hard calculation. And number two, if you're under a lot of cost pressure, you know, what is the cost benefit? You know, just simply abandoning your affiliates and saying, you know, we're out of this business. It is a real, you know, we are in a competitive marketplace. We're in a situation that's been highly deregulated, starting actually under Clinton, not under the Republicans, in the early 90s. There were rules that at the time that said that production entities, including studios, could not own networks and vice versa. Those rules got lifted. And of course, now you see, you know, NBC Universal is the same company, Fox, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's an environment, you know, just like you see airlines, there's nothing intrinsically that said the airlines can't charge you excessive fees for checking baggage. And now they never used to. Now they do. Same kind of questions here. It's a business calculation.
Well, while this has been going on, this Fox-Time Warner battle, another battle has been brewing. Scripps claims that Cablevision pays less than 25 cents a month per subscriber for both, I guess, the Food Network and Home and Garden Television, and so they have pulled those networks off of Cablevision. So the same type of battle, although not gaining as many headlines, is happening with another cable provider and another group of networks.
Well, that's right. I mean, 25 cents doesn't even buy you a cup of coffee or a single flower in a bouquet. So, you know, you can see where they're coming from. Those are low numbers, relatively speaking. But, you know, again, what is the audience? How many people are you talking about? How desirable is that demographic? It's lower profile because they don't carry college football or American Idol. They're not a broadcast network. But these things do happen from time to time. And they turn into, you know, as I said, a game of chicken, whether someone takes, you know, blacks out the signal or negotiates up to the wire, you know, no pun intended. And, you know, all of this is kind of a symptom of the fact that everybody is now up in everybody's business. You have studios owning networks, but also competing with other networks and also supplying product to other networks. I mean, you know, the Fox production entities don't just put programming on Fox. They also put programming, they do programming for, you know, CBS or other networks. So everyone is a frenemy and a friend and an enemy. And, you know, you've obviously got in the cable operator arena, the cable companies are competing with telephone companies. They're competing with satellite. They're competing with internet providers, but they are internet providers. You know, and then you get into the way Google is becoming sort of a phone company, sort of not. So you've got this sort of mosh pit of computer companies, transmission companies like telcos and cable, production entities, handset manufacturers, set-top box manufacturers, TV. You know, my TV offers me internet, and so does my DVR. I mean, they sit in the den and they, you know, they fight when I'm out of the room.
So this is going to be the toy story of Toy Story 4, your TV and your DVR will fight with one another.
Well, it really is the toy story of our decade. And, you know, and that's not to mention the video game companies who want to, you know, who fight for time on your television set. Don't be watching TV of any sort or DVDs.
Well, this will all come a head with NBC and the Comcast NBC deal.
Well, that's right. And you know what, if and when that deal goes through, You know, NBC is one of the three owners of Hulu, and it's pretty clear that Comcast, to preserve its cable franchise, is going to want Hulu to go behind a paywall. And you'll probably see a change in the Hulu leadership if that happens, the Hulu management, and you may see a fight between NBC Universal and on the one hand, and Disney and News Corp on the other, who are the other two owners, because although they're the other two owners of Hulu, they don't own cable systems the way Comcast does. So that's a perfect example of how parallel companies actually aren't quite so parallel and have different interests.
Well, so Jonathan, my head's spinning a little bit. If they go a la carte, does that mean that just the cable companies and the channel itself would split whatever price they charge for that channel? Say you pay a dollar for a channel, then they would split some, they would figure out some fee, like the cable gets 30 cents and the channel gets 70 cents or whatever. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but if you charge 50 cents a channel and you've got 200-300 channels, suddenly my cable bill is $150.
You know, so going a la carte, you know, might be better for some of the individual channels, but maybe not for the operators. And, you know, it's all a question of whose ox is gored. I mean, you might also ask, well, why didn't Time Warner Cable, which, by the way, is no longer owned by Time Warner Inc., they spun it off. Why didn't Time Warner Cable just agree to pay a dollar to the to Fox and then pass it on to the customers?
Because it opens the floodgates.
Yeah, you'd open the floodgates is one thing. And the other is that some of the customers would be driven to cancel. What, you know, what would they do? They'd drop their cable. They'd watch only on the internet. And then you could say, well, but, you know, Comcast is an internet provider as well. They probably might stick with Comcast. Well, they might or they might not. They might be, you know, angered enough at Comcast that they'd switch to DSL from their phone company. And they also might be peeled away by bundles that the phone company offers. So Verizon and AT&T, you know, tell them, hey, here's a nice bundle. You know, we'll give you your phone service and your internet for a discount price.
But where does the Telecommunications Act of 1996 factor in? Does it?
That's right. I mean, it factors into the NBC Universal combination. NBC and Universal could not have been cross-owned until the 96 Act, which deregulated cross-ownership. It eliminated what was called the FinCEN rules, the financial interest and syndication rules that prevented that. In terms of cable operators owning program suppliers, I don't think that was ever prohibited, actually, because some cable operators like Comcast have, and Liberty, I guess, have long owned some of the cable channels, the cable networks. We live in a very deregulated kind of era, and vertical integration per se does not seem to be to attract that much scrutiny. It's more horizontal integration. You know, the potential deals between Microsoft and Yahoo would have been horizontal, where search providers would have been combined, and those got scrutiny and eventually, didn't happen for that reason. But all of this, you know, when you look at antitrust, one of the things you look at is, okay, what's the relevant market? I mean, when you say someone will have too much of a percentage of the market, well, how do you define the market? Does it just mean, for example, just mean terrestrial cable, or do you include satellite? Does it just mean broadcast, or do you include the cable channels? And with this increasing mashup of companies and providers and services, the definition of relevant market keeps arguably expanding. That's what generates multi-hundred page legal briefs, and economic studies where people say, okay, well, fewer people are listening to the radio because they're happy enough listening to stuff on their iPod. And it becomes a very complex legal and economic set of arguments that ultimately, you know, in many cases may boil down to politics and what does it sort of quote unquote feel like.
Well, certainly we look forward to staying in touch with you on this issue and appreciate your joining us here today to try and untangle it and try and explain to us what the heck is going on with our cable company.
Well, again, it's my pleasure, and I suspect that we'll have more of those questions.
Indeed, I agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Bye.
Well, that was an interesting talk.
Yes, no, I appreciate it. He called me out of the blue the other day just to say hello, and I went, you know what? Let me rope you in.
We're going to rope you in.
Just as soon as you thought you were over, we pull you back in again.
Yes, Jonathan Handel, of course, again, an adjunct professor at UCLA Law School, and he is of counsel at Troy Gould. He can also be found on Digital Media Law, which is his blog. That can be found at digitalmedialaw.blogspot.com. We will place a link to it in the show notes. And speaking of show notes, they can be found at our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, you name it. You can email us, and please do, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Although any complaints, Karen is the person you should email. Or leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group, and they can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, Michael Gilts can be found in a number of places besides Dairy Queen. Online, he can be found at michaelgilts.com. Also on Twitter, the username to look up is Michael Gilts. Is there anything else you'd like to plug this week, Michael?
Heck no.
Heck no. Is that a new book, a new...
Heck no, my way of saying no to the bad people in your life. It's a, it's an advice book that I'm coming out. I'll be on Oprah in March, and it's going to be very exciting. Heck no. Would you mind picking up the kids? Heck no.
It's an iPhone app.
It's an iPhone app. Heck no. You just click on it anytime you want to tell people what you think of them. Do you think I look good in this dress? Heck no.
Well, now, Karen, you can also be found online, KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
Right?
Yes. Okay. I don't know why.
Twitter, Karen_Woodward.
Yes. Twitter, Karen_Woodward is where you can find all of the tweets coming from Karen's general direction.
You can I'm a copywriter at heckno.com.
You know, somebody should go and reserve that domain really fast.
I'm going to right now.
Okay. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. The username to look up is simple. It's just Sperling. You can look up my writing online at celluloidjunkie.com.
I hate to tell you guys, but heckno.com is taken. We could get heckno.net.
No way.
Well, on that note, until next week, play nice.
Heck no.
Heck no!